Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I was recently in the UK, which was always a stimulating experience, and I happened to catch a marvelous exhibit at the Science Museum, which is pretty awesome and is also free, which is extra awesome. And it's called The Cosmonauts, Birth of the Space Age. And it's a totally amazing exhibit of Russian space technology, including some actual space capsules and marvelous satellites, designs, uniforms, Yuri Gagarin kitsch. It was really, really remarkable. But one of the things that really struck me about it is how much, you know, the exhibit showed a lot of posters, a lot of images that were sort of recognizable, kind of Russian socialist, realist, triumphant images of human beings hurtling into space with this very kind of modern design. And in fact, they began the exhibit with an example of a constructionist Russian painting from the 1920s, and in many ways they were showing how the actual space program, with its, you know, incredibly sophisticated and marvelous and sometimes somewhat janky technology, emerged from a real vision that had as much to do with art and philosophy and metaphysics as it did with the concrete possibilities of going into space. And I realized that in some ways there wasn't an entirely difference between the actual technologies that brought human bodies into orbit and indeed into outer space, and the images that surrounded the space program. These vaulting modernist rockets shooting off into space. So if you go online and check out some of the images of the show, you'll see what I mean. And this conjunction of technology and modernist art and in 20th century images is also the topic of our conversation today. We'll be talking with Megan Prelinger, who is a an archivist and writer, cultural historian from the Bay Area, and her new book is called Inside the Machine: Art and Invention in the Electronic Age. It's her second book, and it's a really, really marvelous collection. You know, today the book seems to be kind of dissolving into the screen, and it's really books that are well produced and have beautiful images in them that seem to kind of hold the spirit of the book. And this is a definite example of one, because what it does is tell you a fascinating and very valuable story about electronics in the 20th century, sort of beginning with the era of the vacuum tube and moving on through the transistor and the microchip and satellites in space and the emergence of early mainframe computers and ideas about technology and information and communication, even bionics. And in addition to, but at telling the story, it's not just a technical story or a story of business, but it's also a story of art and imagery, because what the images in the book are, not the technologies themselves, but the way in which artists, and particularly commercial artists, represented these new and increasingly microscopic worlds in their graphic design, in the advertisements, in the brochures that the businesses and technology firms produced, often for other businesses. So it's not just about sort of consumer advertising, but rather the images that these new and emerging technologies sort of used in order to explain or communicate something about the meaning or the world or the texture, even the philosophy behind these powerfully transformative technologies that really laid the groundwork for our, contemporary internet world. So it's a marvelous, example of how the archive, the work of the archive, of painstakingly going through ephemera, dusty old magazines that nobody really cares about it anymore for the most part, except for you know, wonderful mad archivists like Megan Prelinger, and then discovering all of these incredible treasures that tell a kind of secret story or a sort of marginal story about the development of technology, how it was reimagined, and how the connection between art and particularly modernist art helped inform our sense of what the meaning of these technologies are. So it's a great book, and I'm really happy that Megan opted to talk to us today on Expanding Minds. So Megan, thanks for joining us on the show.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, yeah. So again, congratulations. It's a really fun book. And again, I'm so interested now in the way people can bring images and text together in the book form and really, you know, keep the form alive and keep it moving in new directions. I wanted to ask a little bit. I mean, I know you've been an archivist for a long time, and how did that kind of start? I mean, how did you, when you were a young person, finding yourself, you know, collecting things, collecting images? Was it images? Was it objects? Was it the sort of dusty ephemera? What sort of first caught your attention and sort of began to develop your sense about the value of these kinds of marginal sources?
Well, the work that I'm doing in this stage. Results from, you know, a lot of combined antecedents. There's no one lone antecedent, but I'd say as a kid I consumed a huge quantity of science fiction and, you know, loved best to curl up in the corners of used bookstores and read old paperbacks. So that's a kind of a physical tactile relationship that I had with printed media from the time I was a small child. And then, you know, as a early adult, I decided to become some sort of independent scholar, and I didn't know of what kind. It was partly because I was interested in so many things, I almost didn't know how to focus. I mean, I could focus, but it was hard for me to pick just like one subject. And I was really hooked on the very process of exploring. So after college, I decided to just dedicate a few years to exploring both the physical world through travel and road trips, and also exploring all kinds of libraries and all kinds of sections of all different kinds of libraries to see what kinds of material really sparked me and pulled me in. And over time, I started collecting material from used bookstores. And I mean, it's a long story. It took a long time. But then I collaborated with my partner, Rick, and we combined our working research collections into enough material to open our own independent research library. And that was almost 12 years ago. And then the process of becoming a library builder and was its own kind of set of layered discoveries about different kinds of ways to interact with books, print, and media as evidence, as a keeper, collector, and curator of evidence, and then as an interpreter. So that's sort of where I got where I am. And I, you know, the book that precedes the one we're talking about today is arose directly out of the idea of how do I turn my science fiction fandom from childhood into an energy source for some kind of new work? And what would I find if I looked in as historical evidence at trade magazines about the history of industry, and if I read them as a science fiction novel, you know, what would I get? And I started doing that about 10 years ago, and that's really where I developed this practice of a kind of comparative multi-channel reading, looking at evidence and looking at the dynamic between text and image, and finding that the images were telling one version of a story, while the text was telling a different version. And that discovery, as I said, the dates back 10 years, has been extremely fruitful and has become its own form of practice. And in right alongside of and library building, and that's how I got to here.
Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect way of looking at technology too, because there's a sort of tendency within popular culture to sort of think about, you know, science and technologies as being a sort of strictly, you know, rational domain, and, you know, it's off there on the side and they make products that maybe that influences our lives. But the stuff itself is very clean. It's very understandable in terms of the fact that it's rationality that's producing these insights, producing these technologies. But of course, the sciences themselves have to communicate, and the technologies, they have to communicate themselves. They have to communicate themselves to other scientists, to business, to the consumer, to the world at large. And that act of communication always has this aesthetic, imaginative, cultural, almost, you know, evocative dimension to it. It's part of the thing itself. And there's so much to be learned from tuning into that side of the story. So it seems like a very fruitful way to also get a little closer to, if you will, the meaning of technology and science in the 20th century, almost sort of looking at it as an event both in both of reason and of art. And so it's you know, you can see it very clearly in the work you're doing. Can you say a little bit more about the kind of context of the images that are in the new book, in terms of what sort of, you know, where are these things at? Are they happening in advertising departments? Are they part of the companies that are making these devices? Are you drawing them from all sorts of sources, or were there a certain parts of the industry that were producing these sometimes really remarkable and often very evocative images?
Sure. Something about the history of this kind of very intense artistic collaboration between artists and technologists is that it really started to boom in the 1930s when both science and fine art and applied art were all infused with new raw talent from Europe. People fleeing strife in Europe really kind of changed the face of America, both art and industry, at about the same time. And I found that to be very interesting, because it really is revealed in the literature. And a lot of artists are, you know, working both as fine artists, but their day job is applied art, and they're getting jobs with industry. And it's largely a lot of the larger corporations that are sponsoring the art. General Electric had its own in-house art department and also worked outside. But at the same time, kind of every little scrappy startup also tended to put a lot of investment into how they visually interpreted their work, because they had kind of the most urgent need to convey what they were doing in multiple terms, visual, and the visual terms were much more effective than, you know, a technical description or a technical drawing. So that's kind of the broader context. I looked at a wide range of trade magazines. These are, you know, magazines produced by industry for industry, but also trade literature, pamphlet literature, that sort of thing. And I did kind of the basic research in our own library, but also went to the General Electric Archives in Schenectady and to the Smithsonian to look at things that I couldn't find here in the Bay Area. So that's the kind of broader context.
Well, one of the things that I know from that, you know, when you see the images, you know, and you talk about in a lot of interesting ways in the book is the debt to modernism and to forms of abstraction in these images. And, you know, people, once you look through the book and you see these, you go, oh, yeah, there's that whole zone in the middle of the 20th century when a lot of images, particular of science and technology, have this kind of modernist character. And you can see connections between what's happening in the fine arts and what's happening in these commercial images, sort of a sense of a new language that's moving away from the kind of romanticism and realism of 19th century painting, flatter figures, color play, more abstraction, and that's really the kind of dominant language of the images that you're talking about. And I'm curious, how much of that do you think is due to the fact that there are all these Europeans coming in and starting to set the tone of this picturing of the new emerging electronic universe? Or was that really just kind of an inevitable expression of that era?
Well, two things to say about that. One is that there were Bauhaus and Bauhaus-trained modernist artists who had started their careers in Europe and then moved to the U.S. in the 1930s and 1940s, some even arriving later after the war, who went right to work for industry. And it's their kind of handiwork that stands out most vividly. And I'm thinking of Willy Baum, who is a Swiss modernist-trained graphic designer who came to the U.S. in about 52. And then earlier, Herbert Beyer, who had taught at the Bauhaus, came in about 1938 and influenced the whole graphic art context from that point onward. And then many people were inspired by the work that they saw being done by the Bauhaus modernists. And then the other thing to say is that the graphic modernism as practiced, say exemplified by the Bauhaus movement, was really uniquely well suited to bring some visual terminology to ideas that were really pretty abstract. The idea of what an electron flow was, how electronics worked, what a circuit it could do, and especially when it got to miniaturization, post-war miniaturization, the idea of what a transistor was. The transistor was so small that it really defied direct visualization. And modernists found a kind of accidental but not so accidental harmony between the geometric figures of circuit diagrams and geometric modernism, and just fused the two. And you see that all over the place, and it's just wonderful work. And it really speaks to, I think, the way in which both engineers and artists were really having to find new visual terms for them to apply to the modern world. And in the case of engineers developing circuit diagram language, it was the technologies becoming more complex than an architectural diagram could explain. And there needed to be a symbol language the symbol language needed to be as straightforward and comprehensible to multiple speakers as possible. And that's where you get circuit symbol diagram language. And the process on the part of graphic modernists is not that dissimilar.
It does have a kind of zeitgeist feel, like it's almost too perfect. The conjunction of this, there's sort of the need to represent something that was abstract, so using a language that people could somehow, a visual language that people could identify with, and yet still was signifying something new, a new space, a new dimension, a new way of engaging abstraction or the increasingly abstract nature of the technologies themselves. And then even if you just look at the development of the integrated circuit, that the thing itself, it sort of in a way becomes increasingly a kind of, abstract diagram, a kind of a dense play of abstract form that itself almost appears like a work of art. I mean, if you look at the diagram of a complex integrated circuit, and you add some cool color to it, people have done this, it looks like art. You know, it looks like something. And even the way it's made, the way that the etchings happen and the kind of science that has to go into creating the actual, you know, electronic brains of the computer has a weird resonance with art making practices in the 20th century.
That's right. In fact, 25 years after the influence of the Bauhaus movement came the turn in the 1960s towards what, you know, Lucy Lepard calls the dematerialization of the art object. And that just happened to occur at the same time as micro-miniaturization in computers. And, the synchronicities are really striking. And I tried to excavate those synchronicities in this work.
Well, what do you think about that? I mean, do you have a sense? I mean, I know that personally I tend towards a certain kind of technological determinism when I see these things, in that however the influences are actually happening, somehow what's happening with media, with what's happening with electricity and then electronics, what's happening with the technologies that we use to actually think and communicate and discover facts about the world, that somehow that sort of driving things, and it's driving things maybe more than we want to admit. And then, you know, there's other people say, no, that's too determinist. It's a complicated feedback between different things. What do you think? Well, how do you see the role of the changes in science and technology in terms of their radiating influence or resonance across larger forms, or is it more of a complex interaction that you can't really locate any driver?
I actually think there is a resonance. I mean, I don't know that I would want to make a choice that it's either too complex or too direct a resonance, but I do think, let me step back a bit in time to the early 20th century, when scientists were trying to figure out models for how to think about the electron. And one of those models was the idea of thinking of the electron structure as being like the solar system. And that is a kind of a visual metaphor that, has some real resonance and speaks to the, you know, the magnetic forces that hold everything together, one being the force that holds the electron and the other being gravity and the other being the force that holds the solar system together. And, scientists no less than artists needed kind of to borrow from one domain to the other to think about, to find new ways of visualizing what they were doing. And artists picked up on that and started depicting the electron in terms of the solar system in ways that also anticipated the turn towards space exploration that happened after the mid-century. And I find it really interesting that I think both scientists and artists as far back, and this is a 20th century cultural history, but as far back as the early 20th century, not that it didn't also happen earlier, were engaged in a kind of parallel and to some extent mutually informed process of trying to understand what was unfolding and bring visual metaphors to help organize the way they thought about their work. And you really see this in the pre-war era, especially in depictions of crystal technology, when crystals started to be grown in laboratories. That really reopened the question posed, you know, to go back to the 150 years earlier, with Michael Faraday and Mary Shelley thinking about the relationship between electricity and life itself, is whether new technologies were inherently organic, or was a machine model going to prevail?
I was going to say that to me, that was what one of the things I learned the most from the book is how long and how many different ways we've been playing along that line, you know, since the era when electricity was first explored and first became associated with living tissue. You know, right. There's been this sense that there's something animated in electricity, and then from the technologies that then develop once we move into electronics and we're developing, you know, circuits and new kind of devices, that there's always this weird ghost of the spirit or life. And right. whether that's just a cultural story or whether it's something that is kind of in a way like, I mean, it's like if it's just a cultural story, it's one that we seem to not be able to get away from. And in fact, as we go forward, even the most mechanistic seeming developments almost inevitably become animated in some way or another, either through imagery or through how people think about it or how people engage it. And that whole discussion of crystals and how crystals play a role in electronics, which was very well described, by the way, like I've read other accounts of it that eluded me more than your account. So you've done a very good job at the just at the straight, you know, science the tech explanation stuff, but also just the way in which the crystal really captures a lot of the mystery and the mystique of electronics, as well as the sort of invisible flow of the electrons themselves.
Right, and it's no accident that crystals are, you know, thought to contain properties that enable them to affect the flow of, you know, energy within people's bodies and psyches. And I think the crystal really stands for that kind of inflection point in how electronic technologies are going to be understood. And I think the whole turn in the recent years to, you know, circuits that can be dissolved in the human body as the ultimate frontier, you know, it's not really a new thing because we always did think about electricity. You know, we kind of identified with it once we understood that we had electricity or electromagnetism in our own bodies. And, you know, so I think that it's more than a cultural frame and it's not going to go away.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. Well, I want to actually talk more about the body and biology in a little bit, but we're going to take a break right now.
Okay.
You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking to Megan Prelinger about her new book, Inside the Machine, Art and Invention in the Electronic Age, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Eric Davis, and I'm speaking with pronounce Megan's last name properly, and I blow the first name. Megan Prelinger, about her new book, Inside the Machine. Just before the break, Megan, we were talking about the body. Again, one of the really interesting things in the images that you see throughout the book is the way that the human body is represented, whether it's the skull as a kind of computer device or the whole body as a sort of electronic field. But another thing that's very interesting is the number of women's bodies that appear. And at first, that seems a little bit confusing. Why, you know, you would think this is, you know, science and technology, male dominated patriarchal zone, especially earlier in the 20th century. What is the role of women's bodies in this zone?
Well, I have to think about how to answer that because maybe you can point me to some specific images that you're thinking about. I felt that more of the bodies were masculine that I was looking at. But I want to answer your question in a little bit of a different way, which is to say that the idea of the technology as a masculinized zone is a little bit of a trick played by history, where the masculinization happened in the way it was remembered, not in the way it actually happened. And everywhere I looked in the evidence, even more in technology than in the arts, I found women working in all, you know, in as laborers, as engineers, as researchers, as manufacturers, as inventors, and especially, you know, in the early computer era, all the earliest computer programmers were women. Women are, like I said, the masculinization happened in the way that history got told to those of us born too late to have seen it for ourselves. And I found that really interesting. That was an eye-opener. And You know, I felt like a lot of the use of the human body and the visualization of the electronics was, strove towards some sort of neutral sphere or a kind of depersonalization of the body. Because again, when people are trying to figure out how to identify with new technologies, they're trying to, one thing that happens is that kind of mechanical modes of human thought that are naturally occurring, but are nevertheless obey kind of rules of linearity, get cast as role models for how technology is going to work and be embodied. So you see a lot of, and also with the design influence, very straight-lined ideas of what robots of the future were going to look like, or just what kind of a head shape was going to be a container for an idea of what a computer would be.
Oh, I see. So it's like there's an absence of the kind of messiness of biology, even as the biological form is shown to be kind of integrated with whether it's circuits or electricity. There's a kind of almost a more of a rigid sort of line. But I was really happy that you used the term bionics. You know, this is this marvelous. I grew up watching The $6 Million Man, and there's the Bionic Woman was a great show. And when I saw that word, I realized there was like this whole other kind of story of the integration of humans and machines, the sort of proto android or whatever that I had sort of forgotten almost. Like it was almost like an earlier chapter of a story that, you know, we're immersed in and is going to continue to envelop us in you know, as we go forward. What do you think what do you think is important, or what lies for us in remembering this kind of earlier phase of the bionic imaginary?
Well, like you, I grew up watching The $6 Million Man, and I was really influenced by reading the novel that it was based on, which I had not read as a kid and didn't discover until adulthood, the novel Cyborg by Martin Kaden, who had been a space journalist. And what I really found interesting about, and I'll get back more directly to answering your question, but that the idea of his novel as a space journalist was to come up with a story of what happened next at the end of the astronaut program. And the novel was published in the same month as the final Apollo flight. And the idea was that the new horizon was going to be the human body. But by then in 1972, it wasn't really a brand new horizon, because especially in the field of space technology, people have been trying to figure out how to integrate humans and machines more efficiently since the 1950s. And I think what we get from remembering that is something about how different kinds of horizons shape investigation, and also something about how the world we're living in today is one that we as a kind of human collective, collaborative mind have been thinking about for a very long time, and are thinking about it has changed as technology has changed. But a lot of things that are discussed in contemporary media as if they are new are not that new. The idea of integrating machine parts into a human body started in the post-war era.
Yeah, it sort of seems like we're really in, in a way, like we still, it's like something happened in World War II, and we're still kind of in the radiating, explosion from all the technologies that developed then and then entered into, civilian life, as well as continuing to drive the military. And it does seem really important to remember, maybe it's because, like you, I have a historical focus or a cultural historical focus. And so for me, these things seem very important. But particularly around technology, because there's such a tendency to emphasize the new, the novel, and even the kind of like apocalyptic, like, oh, now we're just about to turn the corner into some new, you know, terrifying cyborg future. And while there are, you know, new developments that are unsettling or fascinating or potentially quite transformative, you know, we've been playing at this from a long time. And I guess from the story that you tell, because these are images coming from industry, they are, you know, coming from the people who want these technologies to succeed. How much, you know, I guess what I would say is, like, how much are they also disguising, or how much are they also sort of, tricking our eye from other aspects of these technologies, whether how embedded they are with the military, or the emergence of new regimes of surveillance, or the other kinds of more challenging sides of technology that we're dealing with today. Is there kind of almost a sort of beautiful naivete about these moments, or do you think that these documents that you picked up and these images you're looking at are really already embedded in some of the more problematic aspects of technology, even in the time that you're looking at?
Sure. There are, so one of the projects of this book, it results from things I learned doing the research and the way that the artists actually collaborated with scientists doing site visits to laboratories and having conversations and doing interviews with inventors to try to understand in their own terms what they were inventing. And so part of this project is to a little bit remap the authorship of the work from away from the companies that commissioned the work and back onto a kind of social relation between artist and engineer that, although it was heavily mediated by this corporate frame, you know, there was something authentic there that's, you know, different from just it's not the same as propaganda, or it's authentic, but alongside of propaganda. And yes, so many of the images are offering a propagandistic function to, you know, divert. In some instances, to divert attention on the part of the public away from war production and towards utopian notions of technology. At the same time, inside a lot of the trade magazines, the war production elements often, like there is an intertextuality there to the advertisements, that the visuals would offer a utopia, but the little text block underneath would actually kind of say, no, what we really need, this is a recruitment advertising, and we need people who know how to, you know, program mainframe computers to calculate missile trajectories. And often the language would be very direct and not veiled at all, because the war production industry, you know, really did need the people. They used the image to get the eye, but the language to make sure their ad drew attention from the people with the qualifications they were looking for. And sometimes, you know, the production of things like surveillance was considered, you know, more directly utopian back then, like it was something that was going to enable us to be safe and win wars and things. It's astonishing the extent to which the contemporary surveillance state is prefigured in these, well, in systems like the SAGE system, but, you know, were just beautifully promoted in the images designed to recruit people to go work in the SAGE system.
Yeah, there's something particularly ironic about, you know, now that we're aware, you know, aware of this, our contemporary surveillance state, at least to a certain degree, when you look back at all sorts of documents, whether science fiction movies, novels, you know, images of, you know, global consciousness, ideas of the global mind, And there's all these ironies in these utopian or progressivist images now that we can't shake. It's a very interesting kind of backwards resonance. Another thing I wanted to ask about is the sort of this relationship to art, between art and science. It's a hot topic these days. There's all sorts of places. Artists are attempting to revitalize and move into new zones by engaging with technology and science. Technology and science sees it as a kind of outreach, or universities really love this connection because it allows them to be groovy humanists and do their development for their R&D for industry. And then the kind of explicit connection between art and science goes back, at least to the 60s, where you have these very explicit sort of connections, people drawing people together and seeing what can happen. But your research, you're kind of digging out an earlier kind of era of a relationship between art and science that's less sort of self-conscious, that's more happening kind of in the interstices of the industry itself. What changes there? What have you learned about that larger story of the relationship between art and science in the 20th century by looking at these earlier commercial situations that nonetheless were engaging big questions of representation? How do we represent the invisible? How do we use abstraction? How do we use surrealism as a way to actually explore things? I mean, there's a lot of big art going on in these images, and yet it's not as self-conscious as we have now.
You're totally right about that. And it was something when I discovered it that got me very excited about the material, that fed a sense of excitement of a discovery of something really new. I mean, it's not new in the sense that it happened many years ago, but it's a new frame to put around material that hadn't been looked at before. And I think it was overlooked in kind of conventional histories of the relationship between art and science, because the way in which the work is mediated in these corporate environments is not totally understood and also or recognized as a collaborative environment. And also because this particular graphic material, it was mostly appeared in publications that were not aimed at the general public, and they certainly weren't aimed at a fine art audience. I think a lot of this work has just been unseen by people who are thinking about the history of the relationship between art and science. So that was exciting to me. And I think the early ways of defining collaboration were about pulling like experiments in art and technology. The EAT group in the 1950s started pulling scientists out of laboratories and getting them to make art, and bringing artists into laboratories and getting them to make art with, and there's an instrumentation there where the technology becomes an instrument for the making of art. And that's sort of where the germ of the, the current frame of the relationship between art and technology comes from. And that's, it's a huge and fascinating world. But I felt like when I started studying this material and putting it together, like I was lifting a kind of a curtain that hung behind all of these currently broadly understood discourses of art and science, and found this sort of, painting on the wall in the room behind them.
Yeah, and it's also interesting because, again, watching, particularly as the book goes forward and things shrink and become more invisible, then like the challenges increase. And particularly when you get to the sense that part of what you're representing is not just electronics or even a circuit or an integrated circuit, But even more abstract things like the idea of a system or the idea of information. I mean, what is information? Information in some sense is something that we that exists as a kind of object in the world. And on another level, it's an extremely abstract idea that we use to serve all sorts of other purposes. But increasingly, it is information or data that is being kind of sold or represented in these images. And, you know, there's a wonderful part where you collect all the abacuses that keep reappearing. And I'd completely forgotten about them. And when I saw them again, I remembered images that I had seen when I was a kid or whatever, like the abacus is some kind of symbol of sort of human but not really human information, binary kind of things, and the dots and all this sort of marvelous stuff that recalled images that I saw when I was a kid looking through computer magazines or, you know, other science fiction stuff. And so I think that's sort of the kind of one of the questions as we sort of wind up here is just what happens, what do you see happening when these artists bring their skills to bear on these increasingly abstract concepts that nonetheless really, you know, undergird so much of our era? Do they lose, does it become difficult, more and more difficult to kind of represent? Do things have to become more symbolic? What happens when they try to capture these increasingly invisible and abstract forces?
Well, let me answer that by circling back to something we talked about at the beginning, which is the influence of Bauhaus modernism. One of its features, as well as being a feature of other early 20th century European modernist traditions, is the integration of language elements as graphic elements. And the modernist artists who were making art for industry really drew on the tradition of playing with typographic elements, both letters and then the great innovation of the artists doing work for industry was to bring in number forms and use number forms as artistic strategies to talk about or to describe the development from machine to process and different kinds of processes, and graphically depicting different kinds of machine processes through typographic art. That's actually my favorite chapter. And it even speaks to something you mentioned, the word bionics. I tried all the way through the book to track changes in, you know, small changes in language where those changes were introduced an element of excitement into the way that technology was understood. And that's really where I see, the use of language forms being put to work when a different degree of abstraction was required beyond just geometric modernism. And then, that's the primary aspect.
Yeah. Since the book is both a story of 20th century electronics and a story of modernism as a design space, as a visual language that enables the communication or enables us to interface with these electronic devices or picture their potential, is that still with us? I mean, you know, here we are, 2015. You know, there's so many other things we could say about how technology and even the more invisible and technical parts of technology are represented today, whether in consumerism or in more intra-scientific kind of expressions. Is this modernist legacy still with us, or is in some sense does it kind of close off at the towards the end of the 20th century?
It really changes fields is what it does, not so much as close off. It gets absorbed into the design of the devices themselves. And that started happening as soon as Raymond Loewy, the designer, got involved with the design of the look of mainframe computers. As really in the 1960s, the language art is the kind of creative apex of the art for industry. And then photography becomes ascendant at the same time as mainframe computers become ascendant. And that kind of suddenly industrial magazines are filled with photographs of mainframe computers, and the work gets a lot less interesting, and that's why the book sort of ends there. But really, the story of the relationship between modernism and electronic technologies, is still unfolding in front of us in device and user interface design.
That's a really interesting kind of dimension of it. Are you going to continue looking through stuff? We just have a couple of minutes here left. Are you going to continue in unearthing the archive of the 20th century visually, scientifically, technologically?
Well, I'm unlikely to completely stop. Right now I'm researching the history of sponsored films that were made to explain the advances in computing in the 20th century, and working towards doing some cinema programming next year. And, one thing, when I finish a book and start talking about it, I start understanding the work even better than I did when I was writing it. And that, always becomes a kind of creative sort of phase. That's the phase I'm in right now, and working a lot to develop our library. So please invite visitors to listeners to visit our library, PralingerLibrary.org.
Absolutely. It's a great place, and if you're in San Francisco, you can visit the physical side of it as well. And Megan, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you so much, Eric. This was great.
Wonderful.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah. So again, Megan's book is Inside the Machine, Art and Invention in the Electronic Age. I can't remember who we're talking to next week, but it's somebody interesting. It always is. So tune in next week, and remember to keep your minds open.